From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. With her much-needed victory in Pennsylvania, Senator Hillary Clinton keeps on fighting for the White House.
Some people counted me out and said to drop out, but the American people... Well, the American people don't quit, and they deserve a president who doesn't quit either.
Hillary Clinton took the Pennsylvania primary by 10 points last night. But how much does that change the delegate math? For more, we have NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hey, Ron.
Good to be with you.
Yes, always great to have you on. So she pulled off this double-digit win. Some predictions were saying that she'd win by 4 points, 5 points. She had been up by, 22 points way back in the race. Was this not just a victory, but a major victory?
It was a necessary victory, and that's the most important thing. If she hadn't won this primary, it would be very difficult to continue to make the case for her candidacy. But having won it, and having won it by around 10 points, it looks like the final margin may be a little under that. If she's won it by this much, she can say, I'm the champ of the big states that are the base of the Democratic Party when it wins a presidential election. And that's what we're looking at in November. And don't I look more like the profile of a Democratic winner than somebody who's running up, 30-some states and winning a lot of caucus states and, basically looking more like somebody who's depending on independents and crossover voters?
Now, how does this affect her chances in the primary race when it comes to delegates, both earned delegates and superdelegates?
It has a small immediate effect on the pledged delegate count, about 10 thereabouts, maybe a couple more when they finish doing all the calculations. But the way the Democratic rules work, unless it's a total blowout, the winner does not get that many more delegates than the person finishing second. And in this particular state, where certain districts, particularly in the inner city, have had much greater Democratic participation, much greater Democratic margins, they get more delegates disproportionate to their actual proportion to their actual population. So that's another plus for Barack Obama, as it has been in some other similar states. So the delegate effect is not great. It brings down his advantage among pledged delegates by about 10, and that's not going to make any difference. So what she has to do is leverage that to get a bigger payoff from superdelegates by telling them, look, I've got to be your candidate in November. You still have time to make this decision and reverse the judgment of the pledged delegates.
Who was in whose camp? What I mean by that is racial demographics, age, first-time voters, any sense of who went for whom?
Oh, it was quite clear as it's been in any of the primaries, where you had, for example, African-Americans splitting 9-1 in favor of Barack Obama, while Hillary Clinton won the white vote, particularly among women, but also among men. Barack Obama needs to get close, at least among white men, if he's going to win a state. And in this particular case, the margin was almost as great for white men as it was for the overall vote. About 53-54% of the white men voted for Hillary Clinton. Now, as far as first-time voters, and there were a lot of them, about 20% of the overall vote was cast by people who were voting in their first Democratic primary. Some of them had switched over from being independents or Republicans. Some of them were first-time voters. And among those people, 60% voted for Barack Obama. So that was where he was doing well. Also among, and this is a kind of a overlap group, a similar group, the people under 30 years old. There he was winning 3 votes out of 5.
Now, this was one of the first sets of, campaigning where we saw Obama really try to engage in negative campaigning. Do you expect to see more of that? And how did the tactic work for him this time around?
It all depends on what you mean by negative campaigning. If you mean taking shots at your opponent, yeah, he's done that, particularly in Pennsylvania, more than in earlier states. And yes, we will see him say more critical things about Hillary Clinton, particularly in counterpunching at some of the things that she's said about him or implied about him. But it does not necessarily redound to either candidate's benefit to do this. Interestingly, in Pennsylvania, a majority of the voters, even though Hillary Clinton won easily, a majority of the voters thought she had run the more negative campaign in Pennsylvania. And we've seen that in other states as well, sometimes by a great lopsided margin, such as in Wisconsin. So that's not going to be a solution. For Barack Obama to decide he's going to get much more negative will only attract attention to his doing so and make him look desperate.
And what races are we looking at next?
On May 6th, there will be primaries in North Carolina and Indiana. And if you combine those two states, they've got about 30 delegates more than Pennsylvania. So if Barack Obama could win both, he could, to a large degree, counterbalance or even erase the memory of this Pennsylvania result. He's well ahead in North Carolina. That doesn't look to be too much of a problem for him. But Indiana is quite close. The most recent polls have him ahead by just a hair. I think we'll see quite a few more polls in the next 2 weeks, and it's going to be quite close. The demographics there are maybe just a little younger, so that helps Obama a little bit. He does not do well among voters in their 60s and older. And the demographics do not have quite as many African Americans as in Pennsylvania, but it's a substantial enough number to be helpful to him.
All right, Ron, thanks.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, and he joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now we've got more on politics from Robert George. He's an associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. And Melissa Harris-Lacewell, she's an associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hey, Farai.
So, you know, we just spoke with Ron Elving, who broke down some of the numbers with 55% for Clinton, 45% for Obama. Melissa, has this primary changed the race?
Well, it continues to matter in the race in that it continues to spend Democratic Party resources and increase Democratic Party participation. So both good and bad, it matters. But it hasn't fundamentally changed the race. It is still a situation where the math favors Barack Obama and time favors Hillary Clinton. She is using the time that is left to make an argument to the superdelegates. Barack Obama and his campaign are trying to keep the math in their favor. And so that was true after Ohio, and it's true now.
Now, I want to play a clip from Hillary Clinton's speech last night.
The women in their 90s who tell me they were born before women could vote, and they're hopeful of seeing a woman in the White House. The mothers and fathers at my events who lift their little girls on their shoulders and whisper in their ears, "See, you can be anything you want."
Now, Robert, when you think about this election, is it actually an election where we should be thinking, how does being a woman or being an African American help you win the presidency, this time around at least?
I think it's still about, obviously, it's primarily who America is electing at a given specific time. Hillary Clinton, interestingly enough, is making a much more overt appeal to women as a female candidate than Barack Obama is. I mean, Obama obviously presents himself as a candidate of change. His biography is clearly known. He's obviously a black man, and so forth. It's all out there, but. When he uses the inclusive we, he is making a broad appeal across racial lines, appealing to younger folks, things like that. He does not say I'm a black man, vote for me, I'm a black man. Partly because he recognizes basic math. I mean, African Americans are only about 13% of the population, whereas women obviously are about 50%, if not more, in terms of voting. So that's a little bit smarter. Hillary Clinton, though, I think, in a sense, again, talking about finding her voice, and I think, in a sense, something is a little bit more fundamentalist change in the context of Pennsylvania, because she can now say she, a woman, particularly a kind of tough, battling woman, has won two heartland states with white blue collar voters that the Democrats desperately need in November. And I think she has a much more powerful talking point to get the superdelegates to come her way at the end of the primary process.
Melissa, do you think that Barack Obama is going to be able to attract these working class white voters? Is he going to be able to get crossover voters?
You know, I suspect that there are some working class white voters he'll be able to pull. There is no question that if Barack Obama is the nominee in November and running against John McCain, race will be an issue. But I believe it to also be absolutely true and silly to imagine otherwise that if Hillary Clinton is running against John McCain in November, that gender is going to be an issue. And that although she sort of made this argument about, you know, you can be anything you want to be to girls, well, those are Democratic daughters that she's talking about. For the most part, we have not seen a big influx of Republican women, you know, registering to cross over to vote for Hillary. We simply don't see that kind of gender gap in general in American politics. Doesn't mean that it wouldn't happen in this case, but in general, we actually see Republican women voting as Republicans, Democratic women voting as Democrats. So while there is this gap on the basic math, as Robert just said, doesn't necessarily translate into something in the generals. So race and gender are going to continue to be important issues for the Democratic Party running against an older white man in the person of John McCain.
But what I think has to be noticed, and this was, I think, in the MSNBC exit poll following Pennsylvania, and this is something that the Clintons obviously are going to emphasize for towards the superdelegates, Hillary Clinton's base, to the extent that it is older white female voters, are more likely not just to not vote if Barack Obama is the nominee, but to cross over and vote for McCain, whereas Obama's voters, either they'll stay with the Democrats or they might just not vote, but they're less likely to actually vote for McCain. So that's something that the Democratic powers that be have to keep in mind.
Let me jump in, Melissa, because we have to go to a break, but we'll give you a chance to talk afterwards. So Melissa and Robert, stay with us. We are, again, going to take a quick break and come back to more politics. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are back talking politics with Robert George, an associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Also, Melissa Harris-Lacewell, associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. So, Melissa, when we left you, you were about to jump back in on the issue of swing voters, McCain, you know, white voters, working class voters. What was on your mind?
Well, I just want to say that the key here is that this is actually this language of, well, Obama supporters are simply going to come along, is actually a shift that's occurred with many of the Hillary Clinton talking points, because it was originally particularly sort of the language around African-American voters on urban radio, on sort of black net space, saying that African-Americans are not just irritated about the possibility of a candidate who they're supporting at 90% not winning the nomination, but that part of it has to do with the Democratic Party employing, through the Clintons, what they perceive as race-baiting strategies. I think if we imagine that African-American voters are simply going to show up and vote for whomever becomes the Democratic nominee, that you are, that we're sort of failing to read the public opinion tea leaves. I think there are real possibilities about how, as this goes forward, each candidate begins to alienate the supporters of the other candidates. And that's exactly what you don't want if you're trying to put together a win in November.
But there are two different ways that alienation can play out. If it plays out solely as staying home, that's bad, but it is not as bad as, from the Democrats' perspective, it's not as bad as if they then actually cross over. Because in the first case, you're just losing one vote. But in the second case, it's really losing two votes because the vote is going over to your opponent.
But it's not just the presidency. African Americans are what hold House seats in the South. They're what holds gubernatorial houses. The African American voting bloc coming out to vote for the Democratic at the top of the card makes all the difference in the world for the Democratic Party, from dog catcher to Senate. So I would disagree. I actually think that for Democrats, even more than Republicans, the demobilization of a central base, which helps to provide some balance throughout all these parts of the country, which are red states in the Electoral College, which would at more local and state levels make a huge difference to have these Democratic voters. Having them stay home could be an absolute catastrophe for the party at all levels.
Well, Robert, let me spin it this way. A lot of folks are also saying that the Republicans may actually lose out, even though there's a prolonged fight, because so many new voters are registering who are Democratic supporters. So do you think that this prolonged primary could actually hurt the Republicans in a sense because of these new people who are coming to the voter rolls?
The honest, I'm actually going to give an honest answer here and say, well, all of my answers are honest, but I will just say honestly, I don't know how that's going to really play out. I mean, I think there are a lot of Republicans definitely concerned when they notice, I mean, even before John McCain clinched the nomination, that every single primary and caucus, the Democrats were turning out in ratios of 2-1 over the Republican electorate. That's definitely a concern. But what is going to happen? What will be interesting to see is that Barack Obama is one of the few candidates who's come along that's made these appeals to younger voters and actually been able to get them to the polls. Often there's all this enthusiasm. They come out to the rallies, but then they don't vote. So far, they've come out and voted for him. So if he is the nominee and he's able to, you know, keep that connection with younger voters and bring them, I mean, he could conceivably swamp the Republican base. But then again, it gets back to what we were saying before. You know, are the Hillary people going to do something different? I would say the enthusiasm gap, as it's called, in favor of the Democratic base, is definitely troublesome for the Republicans.
Melissa, and then Robert, I want you to weigh in on the recent moves by John McCain. He's on another week-long tour, been to Selma, Alabama, trying to appeal to folks around civil rights issues, and to Youngstown, Ohio, talking to blue-collar workers. How do you think this has been playing, Melissa?
Well, I think it just goes to prove that, you know, primaries and general elections are two different things. And what candidates who are good at campaigning, and John McCain is among them, can do is to reposition themselves in the general elections. So here in the primaries, the Republicans largely folded up the big tent. They went nasty on immigration. They ignored African-American voters. But now that they have a candidate, they can kind of, you know, pull it together and start going for big tent GOP politics again. And they've got the time to do it. As long as the Democratic Party stays in its primary mode, it can't start positioning its candidate for a general election run.
Robert, what about that?
Well, yeah, I agree with Melissa. And again, getting back to the point we were talking before, if Barack Obama is not the Democratic nominee, John McCain wants to at least put down a marker to say that, you know, he, unlike other presidential candidates, he's not going to ignore the black. He's not going to ignore the black vote. He's going to want to try and develop some relationships and say, look, you have an option. If Barack Obama is not on the ticket, you know, at least consider voting for the Republican. And McCain also is probably the only presidential Republican nominee who was the only one who stayed true to the whole idea of comprehensive immigration reform. So he is also able to sell himself among Latino voters as well, which are swing voters.
All right. Well, Robert and Melissa, thanks again.
Thanks.
Thank you, Farai.
We've been speaking with Robert George, an associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, and he joined us from our NPR studios in New York. And Melissa Harris-Lacewell is an associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University. Historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, are only 3% of the nation's total, but they enroll 16% of black undergraduates. Many African-American doctors, politicians, and business people went to an HBCU for undergraduate or graduate school, but are these folks stepping up to help their alma mater? We've got News and Notes web producer Jeffrey Bennett with us for more on this and other hot topics on our blog. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So we talked on the blog this week about how many HBCUs need more financial support from their alums. How are these colleges using the web to reach out, and what are folks saying about it?
Well, they're finally using the web, be it social networking or just email blasts, in a way to stay in touch with their graduates and eventually work their way into their wallets, right? So we talked about that issue on our blog, and the responses ranged from one person who said he made giving back to his college a New Year's resolution, to another reader who wrote, "I refuse to give money to those who have proven that they are unable to manage it appropriately." He didn't say what school he went to, but it's not good news.
Yeah. So last week we made history with our first ever live town hall meeting at News and Notes. What's the reaction been online?
Well, we got plenty of reaction about your interview with Mayor Shirley Franklin. We fielded some criticism for our bloggers' roundtable conversation last week about Pope Benedict. And even before our trip, our listeners and readers who live in Atlanta were good enough to give us some tips about places we should hit up and people who we should interview. So we appreciate the feedback, and that video and photos from our road trip are on our Facebook page.
What else do we have going on online?
Well, we're talking about John McCain's trip to Alabama to court black voters. And next up, we'll be talking about the Pennsylvania primary results.
All right, Jeff, thanks.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from our studios at NPR West. Moving on to our Bloggers Roundtable, we'll take another look at presidential politics, plus the rebirth of black radio and the changing face of Harlem. With us today, Valencia Rohner. She runs the blog Diary of a Content Black Woman. She also hosts the internet show The Content Black Woman Show on Blog Talk Radio, plus former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross. He blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts The Kevin Ross Show also on Blog Talk Radio. And Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Good morning.
So let's take a quick look at the presidential race. Senator Hillary Clinton took the primary, but she's still behind in the race for delegates. Total states won and money raised. She's pledged to hang in and fight on. Valencia, is that a good idea for her and for the Democratic Party?
I think it's a good idea for her to stay in the race. She has every right to. I have a blog post that some may deem a little controversial this morning entitled The Obama Campaign, The Ultimate Metaphor for Being Black in America, because I think that she did use a kitchen sink strategy, and the way she won basically is tantamount to the old style of politics. And so I have no objection to her staying in the race.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by her strategy?
The kitchen sink strategy. Mm-hmm. Well, the strategy in which says, you know, we're not getting any traction as we stay and stick with the issues at hand. And so since that's the case, we're going to capitalize upon all these other controversies that kind of put a big question mark over the likes of a Barack Obama, who seems to just have this incredible appeal that just shows no way of letting up with regards to momentum. And so when you are desperate, you do desperate things. And I think her win is a response to that. In addition, independents were not allowed to vote in yesterday's Pennsylvania primary, which also shows an indication that yesterday's primary was not like many of the others that I think Barack would have done better in if independents were allowed to vote. So,
Kevin, do you think there's some hint that Senator Obama might be going a little more critical of Senator Clinton? Last time you were on, you made some highly controversial remarks on that. You don't need to repeat them. But do you think that he needs to go more negative?
Well, you know, Farai, what's interesting, I did make comments about how he should be aggressive with her. And what's funny about that, I feel totally redeemed, because every aspect of her campaign talks about her being a scrappy fighter and she's Rocky. And so when I said, you know, he needs to knock her block off in terms of that Rock'em Sock'em analogy, what are we seeing? We're seeing them promote themselves on WWE, and you see people Saturday Night Live spoofs and so forth saying, let's really see them fight. And it's amazing to me how, you know, she's gone from being this Wellesley elitist to all of a sudden she's a combination of Annie Oakley, Tyler Perry's Madea, and Sacagawea, you know, all in one swoop. And I'm sitting here going, how is it that Barack Obama is the elitist? So when I look at what's going on with this campaign, it's more fascinating to me than John Adams on HBO. Because I'm looking at this going, okay, is it me? And I'm a Republican looking at John McCain and Selma. Barack Obama's the elitist. And Hillary's doing shots. None of this is making sense to me, and yet I'm fascinated. I can't stop watching.
It'll make for a good TV movie. Politics in about 5 years.
Politics has become the new sexy. If you're not talking about politics, you know, the whole gangster rap, hip hop, yo, what's up? Everyone is like, so what do you really think about that immigration, you know, fence that's not being built? They are really making issues of substance become the new black. Pardon the pun.
Well, Sean, speaking of issues of substance, you're blogging about last week's debate between Senators Clinton and Obama. And there was a videotaped question from a Pennsylvania woman about a flag lapel pin. It was criticized by some folks as being not of substance, being, you know, a distraction or fluff. What are you talking about on your blog?
Well, what we found is that particular question really came from an interview that had been
played, you know, a couple of weeks earlier. So I believe that the moderators wanted to hedge the issue, so they went out and found someone else to bring the question so that they wouldn't have to do it. So I don't think that that was a question that was on the mind of Pennsylvania voters. It was something that they wanted to talk about. And as part of the gutter politics, and, you know, the New York Times called it the low road to victory that Hillary Clinton took. It seems like everyone's trying to go down every road except the road of how will we make the country better.
And so, you know, the question was essentially manipulative on the behalf of on the part of the network?
Yeah, I definitely believe that the network wanted to bring the issue in and felt that it would be easier for them to do so if they used a video clip of someone else bridging the question instead of George Stephanopoulos doing it.
All right. Well, I want to move on to a topic that is near and dear to many folks on our panel. It's about black radio during the election. So a lot of bloggers are writing that Barack Obama's campaign has put black radio back into a spotlight, particularly with new listeners who may not have listened before. You've got personalities like Tom Joyner, Michael Basden, Bev Smith reaching new audiences. You're seeing a lot more black faces on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. And then you also have this phenomenon of internet radio. Kevin First and then Valencia, you guys both have shows on Blog Talk Radio. What exactly is it, and what kind of audiences are you trying to reach?
Oh, my God. I actually have to give kudos to Valencia because I blog over Three Brothers and a Sister. Well, Valencia is the sister of Three Brothers and a Sister. And she started saying, you know what? I'm going to try this social networking site, Blog Talk Radio. And because I used to do talk radio here in Los Angeles on another state, on an AM talk station, I said, well, I've already done it. I already know what it's like. And so you do it. I became her co-host. And then after a while, I found myself going, I'm going to give this a try. And it is amazing. I mean, right now, I'm the number one current event show. Valencia has the number two. We are just my last show alone. I had 20,000 downloads. And what I'm finding is on a blog talk radio, anyone can be a host. And so when you have African-Americans who are blogging, who are talking about these issues, they are now saying, you know what? I don't need to wait for a Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity or Larry Elders. I can have my own interaction and spin it my way. And what's amazing about that is we are now creating a community of folks who either are doing their own shows or they themselves just want to be able to have a different perspective other than what they're seeing in traditional media.
Do you feel like you have more control over the content, Valencia, in this form?
Oh, absolutely. I think Blog Talk Radio, created by Alan Levy, has been a great avenue because for years I was, and in some ways still, am a talk show radio junkie. I mean, and so after the whole Reagan era came along and Rush Limbaugh became on the scene, there became this whole issue of angry white man radio. And so while I have no problems with that perspective or that voice, there was clearly an imbalance of another perspective. And so while you've got the Michael Basins and the Tom Joyners coming on board, Blog Talk Radio allows for other perspectives and people have more control to what they listen to and to really weigh in and have a voice in the broader discussion as it relates to the issues that concern us as Americans overall.
Well, guys, we're going to have to take a break, but I'd like you to stay with us. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Let's continue with our bloggers roundtable. We've got Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South, Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister, and Valencia Rohner of Diary of a Content Black Woman. So welcome back, guys. And Sean, I'm going to jump back into this whole conversation over black radio, really by going back to the more traditional black radio, people like Tom Joyner recently. You know, there's a lot of discussion of Tavis pulling away from his role at the Tom Joyner Show. But do you think that the momentum that black radio has built up over the course of this election will be sustained, particularly with people who, you know, have not been the traditional base, people who might be, for example, non-black listeners who are tuning in because they want this perspective at this time when a black man is one of the candidates for president?
Yeah, I really think that this will be sustained because we've already seen it sustain itself. I think the black radio movement started at the same time as the black blogger movement. When a 14-year-old in Paris, Texas, got 7 years in prison, and radio stations, personalities like Ricky Smiley in Dallas went out and protested. And from that, you moved to Michael Basden, who was awarded by Al Sharpton for his participation in the Gina Six movement. And so when we moved to the election, it was really an extension of a movement through black radio and black blogs that had already been progressing. And so really there was already an infrastructure in place for this black radio movement. So I think it will sustain itself because we've seen it for well over a year now, the same parties holding it together.
But Roy, if I can just jump in, though, here's the problem. Black radio is dying. When you look at the number of radio stations that typically do R&B and then they may have some social commentary either in the morning or maybe on a Saturday, you're seeing fewer and fewer of those media outlets. You know, I actually saw the article that Sean wrote, was featured in the Philadelphia Tribune when it talked about Blogger Nation. And it was speaking on the passion. I think you were talking about Shaquanda Cotton, Sean, and you were featured in that article. And I found it was really interesting because it was talking about the interactiveness that bloggers are having. And I see the internet as being a natural extension of that because in Los Angeles, for instance, we had a major Radio 1 station that was sold to a group of Mormons. And now they're playing Bruce Springsteen, and I like Bruce Springsteen, but at the same time you don't necessarily have in all the different cities across the country black outlets that are really focused on the issues. And so I think between what's going on with black publications, because traditional media in terms of newspapers and magazines, that circulation's dwindling as well. So people like Sean out in Dallas and Valencia, who's doing her thing, and what we're doing over at Three Brothers and a Sister, that is going to be the media for African Americans globally to be more interactive and really get their perspectives out there.
But Valencia, there's still not the same profit motive in online, at least in most online. If you're TMZ.com, that's something else entirely. But, you know, in general, people are not going to make a huge fortune off of doing socially conscious commentary. So when you think about the impact of black radio, although it is definitely dwindling in terms of number of stations and ownership, isn't traditional media still going to be ahead for a while?
For a while, but you cannot deny the momentum that the internet is bringing right now. It was the internet, along with black radio, that brought to the attention the whole Gina Six thing. And major media tried to ignore it as long as they could, and then they could not deny it. And so the internet can be a social commentary, a function that's necessary to communicate views and points of views that hadn't gotten out prior to now. But it can also be a money-making entity. If you look at the Huffington Post, there is no reason why a conglomerate of African-American-related or issues-oriented sites cannot come together and have the same sort of potential profit impact as a site like that.
And speaking about that, you look at like Essence. Essence is completely redoing their sites to make it more interactive, to do television and content. You look at J.C. Watts, who's getting ready to start this network.
I want to ask you specifically, Kevin, about J.C. Watts. You're a Republican. He's a Republican. Mm-hmm. You're black. He's black. You're a man. He's a man. Anyway.
Wouldn't you like to be a pepper, too?
Yeah, exactly. But aside from all that, he's starting this 24-hour news network. And first of all, do you know whether or not he plans to make it more ideologically based? Do you have any idea of how it's going to be? One person was joking and said that it was going to be B-Fox, Black Fox News.
Oh, no, Valencia, tell him what you were saying. She said it was going to be, what, UTV?
Don't tell that.
Uncle Tom Network.
Uh-oh.
She was like, it's going to be the Uncle Tom Network. And I'm sitting there as a Republican going, slow your roll, girlfriend.
But listen, I guess you're not going to be invited on.
I guess not.
It is inconceivable that you would have a 24-hour news channel that focuses on African Americans and not have all different perspectives. Because, you know, it's interesting. My 10-year-old said to me yesterday, Daddy, are you only interested in voting for Barack Obama because he's black? And I was actually surprised that he asked me that. You know, and I said, well, you know, Barack Obama isn't the first African American who's run for president. And he was like, oh, I didn't know. So we had to have this conversation about Shirley Chisholm and Jesse and Al. And as I was having this conversation with him, I found myself thinking, see, this is why we need these outlets. And so I applaud my fellow Republican JC for stepping up, because what I think is going to happen, I'm going to be the first one saying, hey, you need to have Valencia and I as part of the commentators and Farai, because we love you and we love Nichelle Norris, who I was watching on Meet the Press this past Sunday. But it's interesting to have those all those perspectives at one place, because TV One and BET, you know, they're so busy talking about slap a hoe on BET, that's just not part of the conversations that's taking place, and we want to see those conversations.
Again, Sean, though, when you come back to media economics, do you think that there is going to be a strong base, a strong enough base to carry a network like this? And who do you expect will tune in? Mainly black, you know, because you have black networks that now have, you know, majority white viewers. So do you think it's going to be a network with black people and a mixed audience, a network with black people on it and a majority black audience? Where's the revenue really going to come from?
The revenue is going to be driven by the content, and if they can get the
Bravo.
Best mm-hmm. of the best to come in and be on the station, not just J.C. Watch, you have to get people like Roland Martin, you have to get the Farai Todays, you have to get everybody that is going to bring a great perspective mm-hmm. that people will tune in to watch. And so you just can't say, okay, we have a black network and we're going to put some black people on and they're going to talk about black issues and expect it to sell. You're going to have to go out and get the best of the best, and you're going to have to get Republican views, independent views, Democratic views, but also tap into the blogging generation, the internet generation, and the Facebook generation. So, you know, there's a market for anything that you can get people to watch. And if you give a good content, people will tune in.
And I know someone that used to work at Ebony as a writer for a number of years, 25% of Ebony subscribers were white. And so when you look at the perspective, I mean, right now, the people that are coming on the Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio or coming to Three Brothers and a Sister, they're not necessarily African-Americans. They're not necessarily even African or even Americans. Mm-hmm. But what we are finding is they want to know that perspective. Because anytime you have a Barack Obama give a speech on race that actually had me to the point of tears, and then I turn on traditional AM talk radio, and it was as if we heard two different messages. And I found myself going, this is why we need these outlets. And ultimately, advertising dollars are going to propel that station like it's doing a number of internet and blog stations online right now.
Well, Kevin, Valencia, Sean, that's it for today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South. He was at Cake Mix Recording Studios in Dallas, Texas. Former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister, and Valencia Rohner of the blog Diary of a Content Black Woman. Both were here with me at our NPR West studios, and you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series Speak Your Mind gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. A religious sect, polygamy, and allegations of child sexual abuse in a small Texas town. Earlier this month, Texas police and child welfare officials raided a compound run by the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Texas law enforcement officials, along with state child welfare officials, took 437 children of the polygamous sect into custody. Authorities say the group encourages the sexual abuse of underage girls, but this is hardly the only case where questions of child welfare and separating families come into play. Today, Judge Lynn Toler gives us her take on what it means to be behind the bench and deal with these issues. She's a former municipal court judge who now presides over TV's divorce court. She is also a regular News and Notes contributor. Hello, Judge Toler.
How are you?
I am doing great. So, you know, this case has gotten a lot of heat, and there's new questions about who actually phoned in the allegations. But nonetheless, it's proceeding through the court system. And so far, the judge in the case has ordered that the children stay in state custody. The issue is whether they should be returned to an environment where underage girls are sometimes married to older men. Now, when you think about the very basics of this case, what stands out to you in terms of what a court or what legal officers will be looking for in terms of evidence?
Well, what they'll be looking for is a pattern of conduct and how much that the isolation that these young girls and their women in are doing to them as far as their rights and their ability. You have to. It doesn't matter. Everyone is talking about whether or not the telephone call was actually made by somebody in the compound. That doesn't matter. If that happened, no matter whether it was an appropriate phone call or a fake phone call, once an officer of the court or someone sees, an official sees what they think is sexual abuse or child abuse, they must act. Now that they're in, you have to determine what you're going to do. You've got a tremendous problem here. you are separating children not only from the potential abusers, but you're also separating them from their mothers as well, in that they may be complicit in the abuse. So at this point in time, you have to figure out what is actually happening, which will be difficult because all involved will not tell you what is going on. You have to figure out what are the fundamental rights under the First Amendment that a group has to conduct their own religious, have their own religious principles, but that religious, that right under the First Amendment, though fundamental, is not absolute. Because what you do in a religion cannot impinge on another person's ability to live, and it cannot sanction abuse. So it's a difficult question and a tragedy for the children, no matter how this thing goes.
One thing that's happening in this case that I have not seen happen many times is mass DNA testing to try to figure out exactly who has fathered the children of some of these girls and younger women. Is that a strategy that's being employed more widely these days?
I don't think so. You have a unique set of circumstances in this case. You have an isolated sect where polygamy is the rule of the day, and the children are taught that their father and all of his sister wives, they call them all mother. So they don't really, technically, all of them may not know who their biological mother is, and they didn't look at it that way. So typically, outside or beyond a polygamous sect like this, you know who the mother is. You don't always know who the father is, and DNA testing is done often for a determination of paternity with respect to visitation rights and child support. But this is kind of a unique situation because you're having difficulty identifying who is whose mother, and the child may not know.
Judge Toler, let's broaden this out to how these issues can affect many communities. There are, I remember having a conversation at my hairdresser where one person was talking about the color purple when it became a movie and saying, you know, oh, well, that doesn't happen in black families, and how that started a whole debate over sexual abuse. And, you know, pretty much all communities have a hard time talking about it. But as judges look at these cases, not just with this one polygamous sect in Texas, but in every community, rich, poor, black, white, rural, urban, you'll see cases of child sexual abuse or allegations of child sexual abuse. You know, how much can the legal system do? And how would you rate the legal system these days on dealing with these cases where children and mothers and various people involved may not want to testify?
Well, I always say overall, with respect to the judicial system, we are just keeping a lid on the chaos, and looking at to us as an answer to anything is usually futile. It is, you know, the sexual abuse is prevalent and it is underreported. And I didn't really get to see the depth of it until I was off the bench and dealing with a group of troubled girls, and to see how many, the statistics usually say 1 in 4 or 1 in 3 young girls is sexually abused. That's an estimate, of course, because nobody reports it, but it is very much underreported. And I actually saw those numbers in the 25 girls that I was talking to, not only a case of single abuse upon one, but multiple times by different men because of the nature of their household. So the judicial system gets in it very, very late and not often enough. And what we need to do is step back from that judicial response or a judicial answer and have more conversations earlier on within the household, communities understanding that, mothers understanding what's going on, having more stability in the home, new boyfriend. That was a big issue with those girls, the new guy in the house. And the sexual abuse is usually by family or friends, and an awareness of that and taking it seriously and that thought, oh, that doesn't happen here, has got to be eliminated.
Judge Toler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We were joined by Judge Lynn Toler. In addition to hosting TV's Divorce Court, she's also a regular news and notes contributor, and she joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.